From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
أنا أتمنى إنه يحاكموا كل مجرم.
I believe that any criminal must be brought to justice, unjust detention.
العدالة إن شاء الله تحصل.
And hopefully justice will take its course.
A survivor of the massacre of hundreds of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps more than close to 20 years ago demands that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon be brought to justice. A Belgian court postpones the hearing. The UN says it will continue economic sanctions against Iraq, and the Bush administration warns Iraq it faces attack unless it readmits UN weapons inspectors. We'll talk with a former UN weapons inspector, Scott Ritter. And as UN-led talks on Afghanistan's future government continue in Bonn, Germany, we'll speak with a Somali activist about the role women have played in her country's reconstruction and why she's convening the first Afghan Women's Congress this weekend in Brussels. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. warplanes continued to bomb the Taliban's last stronghold of Kandahar yesterday as coalition-backed opposition forces moved toward the southern city and closed in on suspected hideouts of Osama bin Laden in the east of Afghanistan. In the eastern city of Jalalabad, local commanders said the U.S. government has promised military supplies, logistical support, and money to Mujahideen fighters in anticipation of an assault on an al-Qaeda hideout in the White Mountains, where bin Laden is rumored to be hiding. As pressure mounts on the Taliban, many of the former regime's officials fled Kandahar for Pakistan, ostensibly to visit their families, but presumably with no intention of returning. The stories of rising defections came as the Taliban's supreme leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, ordered his followers to fight to the death to preserve control of Kandahar. The British Foreign Office yesterday ruled out an inquiry into the mass killings of Taliban prisoners during the riot at the Kalaijangi Fort, despite pressure from Amnesty International and the United Nations. Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said many unanswered questions remain about the 3 days of fighting around the prison complex near Mazar-e Sharif. The incident left an estimated 400 people dead, at least 150 of which were Taliban prisoners apparently executed by Northern Alliance troops while U.S. advisors were present. Some newspapers are reporting that the two CIA men who were there questioning the prisoners provoked the uprising. One of those men was killed. Negotiations on Afghanistan's future were dealt a blow when a prominent Pashtun delegate walked out, charging that the ethnic majority Pashtuns were not given enough clout in the new administration. Haji Abdul Qadir was the most senior Pashtun figure in the delegation representing the powerful Northern Alliance and was central to the efforts by the grouping, which is dominated by minority Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, to present itself as representative of the country's complex ethnic patchwork. Qadir's exit came as delegates entered the crucial phase of finalizing lists of delegates to a parliamentary-style Supreme Council, part of a UN blueprint that also provides for a cabinet-style interim administration. Hopes of an agreement were boosted yesterday when the Northern Alliance relaxed its earlier opposition to an international peacekeeping force being sent to Afghanistan. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. We'll be speaking with former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter in a minute. A bomb explosion on a bus in northern Israel has left at least 4 people dead, including the suicide bomber responsible for the attack. The latest attack comes on the 4th day of a mission to the region by U.S. envoys who are hoping to secure a ceasefire and implement a peace deal. Earlier yesterday, Israeli troops shot and killed 2 Palestinians at a roadblock in the West Bank, not far from the site of the bus attack. U.S. peace envoy Anthony Zinni strongly condemned the Palestinian attack, but said nothing about the killings by Israeli troops. The Justice Department announced yesterday foreigners who give investigators useful information about terrorists will be rewarded. Under the new Responsible Cooperation Program, the Justice Department will defer deportation indefinitely for immigrants with visa problems and will allow outsiders to enter the country and apply for citizenship if they participate in this program. Arab groups and immigrants criticize the program. Marwan Kredi, executive director of the Philadelphia Arab American Community Development Corporation, said it's bribery and it's disgusting. It's what I would think some authoritarian government in the Middle East would do. President Bush yesterday defended his controversial plans to let military tribunals try non-citizens accused of terrorism and to let law enforcement officials detain and question thousands of foreigners in the United States. Bush brushed aside criticism of the measures, which have been widely condemned as violations of basic civil liberties, saying they would help protect freedom. Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday that Clayton Wagner is the primary suspect in a wave of anthrax hoax letters sent to women's health clinics on the East Coast. Wagner claimed responsibility for some 300 letters delivered to clinics last month when he showed up with a gun at the Georgia home of an anti-abortion activist last week. Wagner had previously been jailed on firearms and theft charges, testified at his trial that he had stalked clinics for months and stocked up on weapons after God asked him to, quote, be my warrior and kill doctors who provide abortion. It was the first time that the Attorney General John Ashcroft publicly addressed the issue of the number of threats that women's health clinics have received around the country. Attorney General John Ashcroft has said before he became Attorney General that it would be his greatest accomplishment to help have passed a constitutional amendment banning abortion. The Beatles. George Harrison died yesterday afternoon after a long battle with lung cancer. He was 58 years old. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN Security Council met last night to agree on a revised plan for sanctions against Iraq amid controversy over U.S. threats to attack Iraq as part of the so-called war on terrorism. Russia, which has previously blocked British and U.S. proposals for what U.S. officials call smart sanctions, backed a compromise deal under which a new list of the items controlled by sanctions will take effect in June. In the meantime, existing sanctions will continue. The Iraqi government, meanwhile, rejected a demand from President Bush to allow United Nations weapons inspectors back into the country as long as economic sanctions remain in place. The prospect of U.S. attacks against Iraq was heightened Monday after Bush said the U.S. would expand the so-called war on terrorism to include nations that, quote, develop weapons of mass destruction that will be used to terrorize nations. Bush administration officials and even some Democrats have called for the U.S. to move on to Iraq after Afghanistan, saying the country is linked to the September 11th attacks, to recent bioterror attacks, or to terrorism more generally. Asked specifically whether the U.S. would invade Iraq if it continued to deny access to international weapons inspectors, White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said the president left that for Saddam Hussein to figure out. General Colin Powell played down talk of attacking Iraq in the immediate future after remarks by President Bush about possible military action sparked widespread concern among U.S. allies and condemnation in the Muslim world. We turn now to Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, who resigned 3 years ago in protest. We welcome you to the War and Peace Report.
Well, thank you.
So what is your assessment of these latest developments?
Well, it's there's a lot to be concerned of. We have a group of people in Washington, D.C., in the Bush administration who have a personal vendetta against Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This is Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy, John Bolton, the Undersecretary for Arms Control. And it appears that they are going to take advantage of the war on terror to settle their grudges. This is an ideologically driven event. They have yet to make a case that Iraq currently presents a threat to the national security interests of the United States, the region, the world, the kind of threat that would warrant, an expanded military campaign of the sort that has been bandied about. So I'm very concerned because this appears to be, driven by rhetoric, not driven by fact. And in the current environment amongst public opinion, which is rallying around the war on terror, I don't think people are making the distinction between the two.
I'm not sure if everyone understands your history. You were one of the most controversial experts on Iraq, a former weapons inspector in Iraq. You didn't quit because you protested U.S. policy being too tough on Iraq, but you felt that the weapons inspection program wasn't working. And then afterwards, you started, it seemed, to turn around. Can you explain what your position was?
Well, actually, there's been no turnaround or change in my position. I've always been a proponent of the law. And if you're going to pass a law, in this case, the Security Council of the United Nations passed a law requiring Iraq to be disarmed to a 100% level, and then form a group to implement the law, and that was the weapons inspectors, then you have to support this group. If our job was to go into Iraq and carry out disarmament inspections, and we did this for 7.5 years. We struggled against a combination of Iraqi deceit, of Security Council indecisiveness, and American manipulation. Keep in mind, the United States has had a policy since 1991 of containing Saddam Hussein, until which time they can find the means to remove him. And, that's not my job as a weapons inspector. When I resigned, I highlighted the difficulties. I likened it to, passing a law on speed control. You put up a signpost that says, 40 miles an hour, and you put a cop out there with a radar gun, and people zip by at 70, and the cop picks them up on the radar and doesn't stop them. Well, this is ludicrous. If you're going to pass a law that says 40 miles an hour, then you need to enforce the law. If not, change it to reflect what you're willing to enforce. In the case of disarming Iraq, the Security Council passed a law that said 100% disarmament. We did not achieve that. We achieved a 90 to 95% level. And as a weapons inspector, I didn't have the wherewithal to say that's good enough. So we pushed to get the final 5 and 10%. And we got bogged down in that. When I resigned, I talked about, if you're going to have inspectors, then you need to respect the law that they're called to implement. Now, this all went away in December of 1998, when the United States continued to manipulate the weapons inspection process to provide a justification for their unilateral military strike of, Operation Desert Fox. Since that time, I've been saying, because the U.S. discredited the law, that 100% level standard, is no longer applicable. No one could talk about getting inspectors back in to do what I was doing. The Security Council won't back that. Iraq won't back that. The weapons inspection process has been discredited. So you need to talk about a new standard. And the new standard that I talk about is this qualitative standard that accepts that 90 to 95% of verified disarmament meets the intent of the Security Council to rid the world of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs.
I remember when you quit, you were all over all of the airwaves talking about how Iraq hadn't totally disarmed. At about the same time, Dennis Halliday quit the United Nations. He was Assistant Secretary General, and he was in charge of the oil for food program of Iraq. And he called the sanctions regime genocidal. He got almost no attention. Now, when I turn to CNN, I don't see you at all talking about criticizing U.S. foreign policy at this point, saying that the 90% to 95% is adequate to honor the spirit of the law.
Well, as I said, you know, that is the reality. We can no longer talk about getting weapons inspectors back in for the purpose of achieving a 100% level of disarmament. I think it's clear that the Security Council and most of the rest of the world understand that that process was corrupted by the United States, and any new weapons inspection process, you know, must take into consideration Iraq's legitimate national security concerns. You can't have inspectors going in to, spy on Saddam Hussein. You can't have an inspection process that facilitates regime removal instead of disarmament. And, you know, this is what I'm talking about. This is a new, calculus that it talks about fundamental levels of disarmament, qualitative levels, and talks about getting inspectors back into Iraq, not to hunt down the final vestiges of these programs, but rather to monitor Iraq to ensure they never again reconstitute.
What do you think of the Bush administration saying Iraq could be next, and people like Wolfowitz of the Pentagon pushing hard for an attack on Iraq?
Well, again, I think that what we're seeing here is a group of ideologically driven Saddam baiters hijacking the national security of the United States. These people have a decades-long personal agenda to remove Saddam Hussein from power. I respect their agenda. Saddam Hussein's a brutal dictator, that's fine, except that, you know, the reality is there is no support for removing Saddam Hussein, and the process of removing Saddam Hussein is actually counterproductive for, you know, American national security, for regional national, for the world's security. So, you know, but these guys, you know, this is their personal agenda. This is what they're about. And I wish people would wake up and understand that, you know, we're letting a handful of policy wonks let their personal agenda determine, you know, how our nation is going to behave. And this is a mistake.
We're talking to former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, who quit in 1998. I've been watching Richard Butler a lot on television, the former head of UNSCOM, the UN weapons inspection program, your boss at one time. He said it's a waste of time to comment on your claims, Scott Ritter, that Iraq is effectively disarmed as far as UN resolutions are concerned and doesn't pose a serious threat to its neighbors. And in a feature piece in the conservative Weekly Standard, Stephen Hayes called you an American apologist for Saddam Hussein. We tried to get him on the air. We called him many times. He didn't return our calls. How do you respond to these charges?
Well, I mean, how should one respond? This is clearly an effort to attack the messenger and avoid addressing the message. If you read Stephen Hayes' piece, and I tried to point this out, and the one time I had an opportunity to go face-to-face with him, he totally misrepresents everything I've said, everything I've written. It's very clever editorial parsing of my words. He uses an interview I gave with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, he conveniently avoids to put the paragraph above the quote and below the quote to put everything into perspective. That's just the way the guy, you know, did it. He removed sentences from passages so that it appears that I'm saying something that I wasn't saying. Richard Butler, you know, I have to respect Richard Butler's right not to want to address a topic which is exceedingly difficult for him to deal with. You know, when I talk about Iraq and when I write about Iraq, I deal with documented fact. Richard Butler has divorced himself from documented fact, and he deals with rhetorical speculation that seems to be ideologically driven. I'd love to have the opportunity to talk about this with Richard Butler, to debate him on any global stage he wants to, on television, in front of a crowd, anything. He's, you know, assiduously avoiding such, you know, such a confrontation because the fact of the matter is he can't, you know, be confronted with the difficult truth of what he represented while he was the chief inspector, the executive chairman, of how his actions undermined the efforts of the weapons inspectors, and what the actual reality of Iraq's disarmament was. Richard Butler knows what the facts are, and today he chooses to conveniently ignore these. And he brushes this off by saying, he doesn't have the time to deal with me, so be it.
How did you become aware, Scott Ritter, of the effect of the sanctions on the people of Iraq?
Well, you know, as a weapons inspector, we weren't there to carry out humanitarian work. It's not as though we were, you know, our job was going to the factories and the military facilities and the government facilities and search for information that pertained to weapons programs. Dennis Halliday, who you've mentioned, and Hans von Sponeck and others who worked at humanitarian programs, I think they had a spotlight on, you know, the humanitarian difficulties. We had, as weapons inspectors, we were peripherally exposed to this. Of course, you saw the poverty in the streets. You saw the empty markets. You saw, things that indicated that Iraq was not a healthy society. But I'd say that I was educated, you know, one, because I have an abiding interest in Iraq, so I took the time to learn about what was going on while I was doing the weapons inspection. And two, listening to people like Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck talk about this, I hold them in the highest regard. They're men who, have extremely high standards of integrity, who aren't given to exaggeration, and they've opened my eyes to the reality of what's going on inside Iraq. But again, just as an American Marine, a former Marine, we're trained always to protect civilian populations, even in the times of conflict. You have to go out of your way to avoid, bringing harm to civilians. And when you apply that to Iraq, no matter what your, feelings are about Saddam Hussein and his regime, the fact is, to have a program of economic sanctions which holds an entire population of innocent civilians hostage to, because of the crimes of one man or a group of men, that's not sound policy. That's not morally correct policy. That's not what I was trained to be about. So, even if I wasn't equipped with the details of the humanitarian suffering, the details that Dennis Halliday might have, I am a moral enough human being to understand that the basic policy itself is flawed morally, flawed fundamentally. It's not achieving its objective. It's
Scott Ritter,
legal objective.
Last question. That is, since you haven't been there and the weapons inspectors haven't been in Iraq for the last few years, how can you say at this point that Saddam Hussein does not have dangerous biological and chemical weapons?
Well, first of all, I don't think I've ever said that Saddam Hussein does not have dangerous biological and chemical weapons. I've said we don't know what he has right now because we don't have weapons inspectors in. What I can say is, as of December 1998, the programs that Iraq had in place in 1991 to produce biological, chemical, nuclear, and long-range ballistic missiles had been destroyed, dismantled, the weapons themselves destroyed. Now, there was some uncertainties, but this was primarily an accounting issue. We talked about being unable to verify that everything was accounted for. This didn't mean that there was a massive program hiding behind the next hill. No, those programs were gone. And we know what it takes to build these programs. It took decades, billions of dollars, and access to the highest technology. And no one has been able to show that Iraq has acquired this technology, has been able to spend the amount of money required, and has actually reconstituted the infrastructure. So it's highly unlikely that Iraq has rebuilt in any meaningful fashion its weapons programs. But we won't know what's going on in Iraq until we get weapons inspectors back in, and we're not going to get them in by President Bush waving a magic wand and demanding them. We're going to have to go to the Security Council. We're going to have to strike a deal, and this deal will probably include the lifting of economic sanctions in exchange for the return of monitoring inspectors. That's the best deal we can get, and that's a good deal. That's one that will accomplish the intent of the council and alleviate the suffering of the Iraqi people.
Scott Ritter, I want to thank you very much for being with us, former UN weapons inspector in Iraq. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll find out what happened in a court in Belgium where the survivors of the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Lebanon want to bring Ariel Sharon into court. Stay with us.
Dangerous rhymes perform like surgery, cut so deep, you'll be bleeding burgundy. My intellect racks and disconnects your cerebral cortex, your cerebellum is next. Your conscious becomes subconscious, soon your response is nonsense. The last words were blurred, mumbled and slurred, then your verbs are no longer heard. You get your lump fries up with your tongue tied. He couldn't swing a hang, so he hung till he died. Reincarnate him and kill him again, again and again, again and again. I leave him in the mausoleum so you can see him. I got a dead MC'ing museum. When I create him, I cremate him and complicate him. You can't save him, there's no ultimatum. Mics lay around full of ashes with the victim's name in slashes. I got a long list and I'ma get every one of ya. Beware of the Punisher.
The Punisher, Eric B. and Rakim, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A Belgian legal panel Wednesday postponed hearings in a case charging Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon with genocide. The plaintiffs are survivors or families of victims of the hundreds of Palestinians massacred at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon in 1982. They accuse Sharon of responsibility in those massacres. The suit against the Israeli Prime Minister was brought under a 1993 Belgian law which allows war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide to be tried in Belgian courts, regardless of where the alleged crimes were committed or the nationality or residence of the victims and accused. The hearing came a few months after a series of documents, including minutes of meetings between top-ranking Israeli and Lebanese military officials, were anonymously delivered to the lawyers representing the Palestinians. The lawyers say the documents provide watertight evidence that there was a conscious and effective chain of command between the Israeli military and the right-wing Lebanese militia, which carried out the slaughter. We're joined on the telephone now by Shibli Malat, one of the lawyers representing the Palestinians suing Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for genocide. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. You're now in France, having come from Belgium, where the court hearing took place on Wednesday. Did you find anything encouraging in that in the court's ruling?
Well, the court hasn't ruled yet. It's still in the midst of pleading. And for the first time, there is something symbolic about those victims bringing their voice through their lawyers to a neutral and independent court for a crime against humanity. But the court was very encouraging insofar as the Attorney General, the equivalent of the highest prosecuting body, judicial body in Belgium, supported all the arguments that the victims had brought forward through their lawyers, that Belgium should proceed with the case because it is the case that falls under the law of 1993.
And can you talk about exactly who you represent?
Well, we represent, originally, it's a lawsuit that was brought by about 28 people. For procedural reasons, they were divided between witnesses, five of them, and 23 plaintiffs. Most of these people have lost several members of their family, and they do represent a large spectrum of Lebanese and Palestinians who lost one or more members of their very close family during the 3 days of massacres in Sabra and Shatila in September 1982.
For listeners who weren't familiar with what happened at the time, can you explain exactly what you are alleging and what Ariel Sharon's responsibility is?
Well, the law is one of those that are known as universal jurisdiction laws, and that is a law that considers that there are such crimes that are so dramatic, so massive, so callous, so systematic, so civilian-directed, that they concern the whole of humanity. These are called crimes against humanity. Now, there are various versions, but the law in Belgium is very well crafted. It includes genocide, crimes against humanity as such, and the war crimes. So the what happened in Sabra and Shatila partakes of all three, and the complaint was brought on the 18th of June of this year under the three heads of accusation against Charon and all others, Lebanese or Israeli, who will be found responsible by the judge for those massacres. The reason why Charon in particular has been singled out is because under international law, the person who is in a position of command is one who obviously is more responsible than even the executioners, because it is under his aegis that the massacre has taken place.
I'm just going to read from The Guardian, the British newspaper, a piece by Julie Flint that was written this week, the day of the Belgian court hearing. And it says, it's September 19th, 1982, the day after the Lebanese forces militia left Beirut's Palestinian camps after a 38-hour orgy of killing. And it is finally possible to see what the Israeli soldiers surrounding the camps claim they had been unable to see. Streets carpeted with bodies, men, women, and children shot and hacked to death, pregnant women eviscerated. In Christian East Beirut, Israel's chief of staff, Lieutenant General Rafael Eitan, the commander of the Northern District, Major General Amir Drouri, and a senior Mossad officer, Menachem Navot, codenamed Mr. R, meet the deputy chief of staff of the Lebanese forces, Antoine Bredi, Toto, and Joseph Abu Khali, the man who made the first contact with the Israelis in March 1976. What ensues is a cynical damage limitation conference in which senior officers of the Israeli Defense Forces utter not one word of reproach for a massacre in which militiamen trained, armed, and sent into the camps by them killed at least 900 defenseless civilians. These documents that The Guardian is reporting on uncovering, how did you get a hold of them that show the Israeli chain of command with the Lebanese militia?
Well, sometime in early July, so about 3 weeks after the complaint was lodged, a huge package was received by my colleague, Matt Wallain, who with me is prosecuting this case for the victims. There was no source. But these were documents in Hebrew and in English, which clearly referred to some which were taken for very sensitive meetings, including the Israeli intelligence with senior members of the militias who perpetrated the effective killings. And so we don't know what the source is, and we presume it is probably Israeli.
And what were some of these documents exactly? What other things did they show in addition to document this meeting that I just described?
Well, these documents show quite a lot of things. Of course, there are a lot of names that until then had not been connected at all with the massacres, including, for instance, Mr. Navot, whose name recurs and seems to have been one of the senior, if not the chief, of Mossad in charge in Beirut, the Mossad being obviously the Israeli intelligence services. But mostly what we think these documents show is that there is a very remarkable chain of command whereby the Falangists for a long time, way before the massacres and even after the massacres, were doing exactly what the top people in the Israeli army were telling them to do.
We're going to go now to one of the survivors of the massacre who lost 15 members of her family. Her name is Wada Sabek, and the Democracy Now! in Exile producer Chris Abrams spoke with her about her reaction to the court hearing, but specifically about her own experience with you, Shibli Malat, translating. This is what Wada Sabek had to say.
On 17th of September, they came and they told us that they were stamping the passport so that you go away. I was with my children at home. They took us to the entrance of Shatila.
أخذوا أولادي مني.
They took my kids from me and my brother.
وجيراننا كمان.
And all our neighbors.
أولاد عمي.
My, our cousins and close relatives. The young man.
وإحنا طلعونا أنا أولادي الصغار على المدينة الرياضية.
And they took us, me and my little kids, to the Cité Sportive, to the sports center.
خلونا للساعة 7 بالليل.
They left us until 7 o'clock in the evening.
فقالونا بتروح على منطقة اسمها الفكاني.
They told us to go to a place called Fakhani.
إحنا نزلنا على جسر الكولا لتحت.
We stayed on the bridge of the Kola with my children.
وهن بلشوا يزتوا قذائف على الفكاني.
And then they bombed, they started shelling Fakhani.
فنمنا ببناية هيك خربانة.
We slept in a desolate building.
للصبح.
Until dawn.
الصبح رحنا عليهم على المدينة الرياضية وقلنا لهم وين الشباب.
So then I went to the sports center and I started asking where are the young men, where are my two boys.
قال يلا بروح عند أبو عمار.
So the Israeli said you go to Abu Ammar. And you get them from there.
إجت واحدة قالت لنا روحوا شوفوا القتلة تحت على مفرق سفينة.
Then a woman came and told us to go to see the killed, those killed, the corpses at the entrance of Shatila.
رحنا لقينا سلفين أولاد عمي كل الميتين بالضروبة. كنا ندور على القتلة فلقينا أولاد صغيرة.
So we went and I saw my nephews and my gender and kids mutilated, young men, women, hundreds of
them.
Then we saw the civil institutions there going and digging a big grave and putting. And the Red Cross, 35 people from the Medad family were taken. There were also Syrians, our neighbors, about 10 people also killed.
Did you lose members of your family?
My two boys and my brother. And my gender, and my cousins, about 15 people from the family, from the extended family.
And how does it make you feel that Ariel Sharon is now the Prime Minister of Israel?
I believe that any criminal must be brought to justice, unjust action. And hopefully justice will take its course with the help of God.
Wada Sabek, survivor of the massacre at Sabra and Shatila. She lost 15 members of her family, translated by Shibli Malat, who is on the telephone with us right now, one of the lawyers representing the Palestinians suing Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for genocide, for responsibility for that massacre. He was the general in charge of the Israeli army that surrounded the camps when the Falangists, the Lebanese militia, moved in and killed the Palestinian refugees in the camps. Shibli Malat, as we wrap up, the lawyers representing Ariel Sharon in court on Wednesday said that the Belgian law that allows you to sue the general for crimes against humanity is discriminatory because it allows anybody to be sued by anybody else. Can you explain their argument?
Well, I mean, this is we're not talking about normal crimes. And so we're talking about a very specific type of crimes, which are so massive, so dramatic, within the context and the magnitude. Perhaps for an American audience, the closest example of Sabra and Shatila is what happened on September 11th, where over 4,000 civilians were killed wantonly in an act of sheer brutality.
Are you speaking on a speakerphone?
Pardon?
Are you speaking on a speakerphone?
No, I am not.
Oh, sorry. If you could just come close to the phone as you can.
Right.
Good. Thanks. You're saying maybe people could understand it by comparing it to the September 11th attacks.
That's right, yes. I mean, the magnitude, the nature of the people, the wantonness in which it was done is one that suggests that the persons who were in a command responsibility, in other words, somebody like Sharon, without whom this massacre would not have taken place, he did give the order for the Falangists to go to the camps and clean them up from terrorists, is something that should stand in good understanding for someone who has witnessed a similar crime against humanity as happened in New York on the 11th of September.
It's interesting because it was Ariel Sharon, now as Israeli Prime Minister, who said after the September 11th attacks that now maybe Americans can understand what it means to feel like an Israeli.
Well, it's up to the, you know, to the selective memory, of course, of criminals is one which is particular. What I think is more accurate is on the receiving end of things, to see how a massive crime goes unpunished, and while it doesn't absolve people who are wantonly killing innocent civilians in Israel and elsewhere. I find it hard to see how Mr. Sharon, who was found even by his own kin, the Israeli commission known as Kahani, as personally responsible for the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, to be able to so selectively describe things with regard to September 11th.
Finally, Mr. Malat, what happens with the court case now?
Well, we have another two sessions, after which the court must decide about the opportunity and the legality of pursuing the charges in Belgium. And we are confident, after the Attorney General has backed our positions, that the court will take the same view and allow the prosecution to continue.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And if people want to get more information on the case, you can go to malat.com. That's MALLAT.com, the last name of the lawyer we're speaking to. Shibli Malat, speaking to us from France, where he and Wada Sabek have gone from Belgium to speak with French human rights groups. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to a Somali activist to talk about women involved in the reconstruction of her country and why she is now leading the first Afghan Women's Congress in Belgium this weekend. Stay with us.
We need to re-examine, take another look into Africa, the black land they call our Cable Line. Here is a story, the teachers of our former glory, of queens and warriors, women strong and brave, refused to be subdued or taught how to behave. They clearly understood the power within comes from God and should not be dictated by men. So rule the nation seated on a throne. Some led in battle, fighting to protect their home. Some studied nature, the sciences of healing. Religion and the arts reflect their deepest feeling. Music, the list is practically endless. The contributions we have made are quite timeless. In almost every category you will find us singing or playing instruments. Upon the world we make our mark, we make a serious dent. We have influence of sound. We offer soul that nowhere else can be found. Touching the feelings that are rich and profound. Words, let's talk about some writers who use the pen and pages, weapons of a fighter. Educating to them poetry and prose, their essays and the novels and the stories that drove a message with a rhythmical spear into our conscious minds to make us adhere to life.
Women should be a priority, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from Ground Zero. The second Ground Zero is now Afghanistan. I'm Amy Goodman. UN-led talks on Afghanistan's future government continue in Bonn, Germany today as representatives of the country's ethnic groups and military factions try to cobble together a transitional government. Afghan women are demanding a role in these talks as well, hoping to end 20 years of systematic exploitation and their near total exclusion from Afghan political life. It's a daunting task, bringing peace to an impoverished Islamic country that's been devastated by drought, invasion, civil war, and most recently U.S. bombing, and ripped apart by local patriarchs who've manipulated religion and ethnicity for their own ends. Guaranteeing women's rights in such a situation might be an even more demanding task, but there is a precedent in the experience of Somalia. In 1993, U.S. troops under U.N. command left a devastated and nearly ungovernable Somalia in which the rights of women were also systematically violated. But in August 2000, after 7 years of UN administration and failed negotiations, 25 women became members of Somalia's Transitional National Assembly. This January, the UN Security Council reaffirmed their commitment to peace in Somalia under that new government, a peace which is ironically being undermined by the U.S. seizure of Somali businesses since September 11th here in the United States. The dramatically improved status of women in Somalia was not a gift. Rather, it was the result of years of patient organizing by Somali women, supported by the international community, who built institutions led by women and involved them in the building of a civil society. Now, one of the Somali activists who helped to bring these women together is working with her sisters from Afghanistan and hoping they can learn from Somalia's experience. We're joined on the telephone now by Hibak Osman. She is a Somali-born women's rights activist and head of the Center for the Strategic Initiatives of Women, which has worked in Somalia since 1993. Her organization is helping to organize the first Afghan Women's Summit, which will take place this weekend in Brussels. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Hibak Osman.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you compare the situation in Afghanistan right now with what Somali women faced in 1993?
As a matter of fact, yes. After Siad Barre left Somalia, the Somali women's, the women's movement has not arrived in Somalia. And it was out of necessity that this woman came out of their houses to organize themselves. And they realized that it's only after they mobilize themselves that they can really make a difference in their own communities. That was purely out of necessity. And if you look at in Afghanistan today, women are also coming out, you know, out of necessity, because they understand that if there is another, that if you, women's rights are not respected, that they are going to get another regime that has a contempt for humanity. And, you know, they also understand that political participation by women in leadership roles is absolutely essential to the to establishing a democratic regime in Afghanistan. So women do this out of necessity, not because they are interested in political positions, whereas men, take advantage of the war. They don't only create wars, but they also take advantage of the situations where they think it's a political bargain and who is going to take what and who's going to be what, you know. Whereas women, it's really how they are going to get health for their children, how they are going to get education for their children, how they are going to survive.
We're talking with Hibak Osman, a Somali-born women's rights activist. Can you describe how, though, in the last 7 years, women have built the women-led institutions in Somalia and increased your role in civil society?
Once women realized that they had so much in common in terms of misery in Somalia, that the fact their children could not go to schools, they could not get health for their families, they did not have jobs, they did not have clean water. That is really the fact that they related to each other as human beings. That was the beginning of good things to happen for Somali women. That's when they realized that if they could speak in one voice, if they could organize themselves, they could help their communities. Because sometimes you will find a community, had a school and another community had the water, and they had to negotiate to help each other on this and to share, and the interdependency and between them was very important. That moved from doing community work into national level organizations and into international and regional organizations. And it was really, we heard all the miseries that the Somalis were going through from the women. And it was only when the women organized themselves through these organizations that we heard, what was happening and how the situation was in Somalia, and that we could support and help, that enable us to help them, yes.
I'm looking at a piece that my colleague Laura Flanders wrote. It's on her website, workingforchange.com, about you and about women in Somalia and comparing it to women in Afghanistan. She writes, in 1993, U.S. troops under U.N. command left a lawless and chaotic place And then quoting you, she says, women were raped, buried alive, bombs were placed in their vaginas. The brutality was unimaginable. Then in August of 2000, the country welcomed a president and a parliament that represented the four main Somali clans, minority clans, and women. The initiative was the result of a three-month peace conference held in the neighboring state of Djibouti. There were few reasons for hope before the Djibouti conference. And she talks about all the earlier peace initiatives. So what turned it around?
It was the women started organizing themselves in 1993. I think the only time that you had all the Somalis meeting was when the women met together in 1993 from different clans, from different factions, and they came together to talk about, to make a difference in their own communities. They were not coming together to make a political statement. They came together as human beings, and they related to each other. And after that, it started, what happened was, you know, after they organized it so much, they went back and they did national workshops on peace, and they talked about peace and the importance of peace. And I think that's really, that was the beginning of that was the beginning of civil society in Somalia. I mean, there was absolutely no history of institutions in Somalia, and I think for the first time, you had womenist organizations coming together, and that was the beginning of setting civil society institutions in Somalia.
We're talking to Hibak Osman, a Somali women's rights activist, who is now headed to Brussels to help lead the first Afghan Women's Summit. Can you talk about what will happen there?
Yes, actually, we are co-conveners with Equality Now in New York and the Feminist Majority and FIDE. And what we are doing is, again, like we did in Somalia, we are organizing to bring women from Afghanistan to Brussels to basically to create a neutral venue for them to come and to talk and to really come up with declarations of exactly where, you know, how they are, to discuss their strategies and their visions for a new democratic Afghanistan. And that's all we are really trying to do. It's going to be up to the Afghan woman to really go back and make a difference in their own communities. We're just bringing them together and just creating the neutral venue for them. And I think it's very exciting, and it has been great working with them.
There have been some odd coming togethers of different women around the issue of Afghan women. For example, Laura Bush, the president's wife here, gave the first radio address by a first lady, by the wife of the president, a couple weeks ago, and she was talking about Afghan women and how important it is to support them and all that they've gone through. I mean, it was interesting considering earlier in the year, it was her husband's administration that had given $40 million to the Taliban. Of course, going way back, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden himself came to power in Afghanistan because of the help of the U.S. CIA with training and financing. Yet, as things turn around now, these issues of the brutality against Afghan women are being raised by this administration. What are your thoughts on that?
They are really doing all they can. I mean, things have changed since September 11, and I have been in meetings at the State Department, in fact, yesterday, last week, and there are all kinds of initiatives that are taking place. And, of course, at the forefront of these discussions is women's rights. But there are also concerns about women's rights and the commitment of the Netherlands Alliance and others, because every time you turn the TV on or you read the articles, you will find an opposition leader cautioning about women's rights, saying, well, we have to move slowly. We are not sure exactly, you know, what we should really do. We have to be careful. And this is really, we are all having problems with this caution. And that's why it's important for this administration to really commit themselves to the women's rights. I mean, we are planning after the summit to bring women to Washington to talk and meet with the Hill, Capitol Hill, to meet with Colin Powell and maybe the White House, and to really discuss what's at stake, because I think America is not ready to lose lives and to fight for a regime that has no respect for the fundamental right of a woman, you know. And this is what we do. That's why it's important to engage the administration and to engage the women's organizations and also civil society in this country to make sure that when there is a transitional government in Afghanistan, there is a commitment for women's rights. Right, the way things look at this point, even though there are a couple of women in Bonn, the discussions are not, of course, the women's rights discussion. Sima Wali is there, and I'm sure she's going to make sure that the women's rights are respected.
Though RAWA has been excluded, the Revolutionary Association of Women.
No, actually, they are there also.
Are they voting delegates?
Yes, I think they are, but this is political discussions. I think it's changed fortnight, but from what
it's
I
understand. It's been hard to really pin it down who exactly is there and actually allowed to participate.
Yeah, I think they are participating. I don't think any woman who is there is going to allow not to participate. Mm-hmm. And again, the eyes of the world are on this summit in Bonn, and I don't think the opposition would really make that mistake. I don't know how committed they are, Amy, and I'm really concerned about this. But they are, of course, saying that with caution that women's rights is at the forefront of these discussions, and it's going to be very important for the transitional government. But let me come back to this.
We just have 30 seconds.
Okay. I think it's extremely important that this government understands, the United States understands, that if this if that new government in Afghanistan does not respect women's rights, then they are not going to respect the essence of humanity or any human right, and therefore we have no business to be in Afghanistan in that case, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Hibak Osman, Somali women's rights activist headed to Brussels for the Afghan Women's Summit. Just as the U.S. CIA supported Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, they also supported Siad Barre, the longtime dictator of Somalia. And that wraps up our program for this hour. I want to let people know I'll be headed to Los Angeles today. Look forward to seeing people at Scripps College tonight at 7:30. And then tomorrow night, a big Democracy Now in Exile fundraiser with Danny Glover and Fire WBAI program director Bernard White. We'll all be there with staff of KPFK and the band and the fire there in Los Angeles. We'll be at the First Baptist Church, 760 Southwest Moreland Avenue in Los Angeles. That's Saturday, December 1st, 7:30 to 10. Look forward to seeing everyone. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! In Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, and as well, Suganya Mahendran. Our video team is Orlando Richards, Rachel Jones, Emily Kunstler. Jackie Suen is our webmeister. Corinna Escamilla, Noel Rabinowitz, Karen Renucci, as well as Dee Dee Halleck. Democracy Now! Can be reached by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to KPFA, Amy Pomerlo, Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News, KFCF in Fresno, all the Pacific affiliates airing Democracy Now! In Exile. We are Pacifica, broadcasting from downtown community television. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Suno, broadcasting on public access television cable access programs around the country. We're broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band and the fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.